Today we get a chance to look at Unit 3, Session 3 of the Gospel Project. We'll be in Genesis 21 and 22 with a few additional references to Hebrews 11. And we're looking at the story sometimes called the Binding of Isaac. This is from Genesis 22 primarily. The birth of Isaac takes place in chapter 21. And then Abraham is asked to offer his son Isaac in chapter 22. I think this is one of the more difficult sections of Scripture from an ethics point of view. We'll talk about this in more detail later, but I think the big question is, what if God's will, as it appears to us to be, contradicts all we think we know? And I worded that specifically in that way to kind of give away part of the answer. What if God's will contradicts all we know would be one question. But when you add in the element of humility, what if God's will contradicts all we think we know? That in the same way you could ask yourself, do I really understand God's will? You also would have to ask yourself, do I really know as much as I think I do about everything else? I think that's part of the question involved in this story from start to finish, and I hope it's worth looking at today. Point one is God providing the son of promise. And this again comes from the previous story that we've been looking at, builds up to it. So by way of review, God promised Abraham a son in chapter 12, and a nation and a people and a heritage. He renewed that promise in chapter 15. Abraham had some doubts and said, well, do you mean Eliezer or Damascus, or do you mean maybe my nephew Lot? And God got very specific in chapter 15, 4 through 6, and said, no, your son from your flesh, that will be your heir. In the chapters that follow, time passes and the promise isn't immediately fulfilled. Sarah and Abraham are already up in years and now getting further along in years. And so doubt mounts, and with doubt come schemes. When we start to think God isn't going to do it, we think we probably should. So Sarah planned at one point to have Hagar, the handmaiden, to be a surrogate mother and to have a child by Abraham so that he could have an heir. If you read the story, and we're skipping it for this purpose, but if you read the story, it's really tragic. The whole chapter is tragic. Hagar is one of those really sympathetic characters to me that gets overlooked a lot. The scheme ends miserably, is the point. It's bad for everyone. Our solution to the problem wasn't a very good solution. So instead, in the next chapter, God renews the promise again and says, no, you're going to have a son. You're going to have a son soon. It's going to happen. So in chapter 21, that's the setup for verses 1 and 2. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised. Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the time of which God had spoken to him. So in the story, the setup, the first point to be made in this chapter is God did exactly what he said. God did exactly what he said in the way that he said it when he said he would do it. God did what man could not. That is, there was no amount of wishing it so that was going to change the fact that Abraham and Sarah are old and barren. But with God, as Abraham says, nothing is impossible. God did what doubt could not. No amount of fretting would replace what was accomplished by faith. That God accomplished what we didn't really see how it could be accomplished. God did what schemes could not. Sarah and Abraham took it into their own hands to do something with Hagar, and it ended horribly, whereas God's simple act accomplishes what we didn't. So one of the early reminders from this story is that God keeps his promises, and our efforts to circumvent them or to rush them often end in disaster, or at least disappointment. Verses 3 through 5, Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, who Sarah bore him, Isaac. Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Isaac, his name has some irony attached to it. The name Isaac means he laughs, or it sounds like the idea of laughter in Hebrew. In fact, if I could just make a side note, laughter as a sound is in the name Isaac. So if you think about how we write out laughter, if you're telling a story and then someone laughs, you might write H-A-H-A, ha-ha. Or if it's Santa Claus, you say ho-ho. If it's Fozzie Bear, you say waka-waka, right? But what does laughter sound like? It's a funny sound, and it kind of sounds like yak-yak-yak. You know, it has that funny sound to it. Isaac is supposed to be kind of this ironic play on the sound of laughter, and it actually means he laughs in Hebrew. This references chapter 18, when God had visited and said, you're going to have a son, and Sarah had scoffed. She said, ah, that's not likely. She had said it behind the scenes, but God was quite aware of it. She had laughed in disbelief and incredulity. But in this story, the laughter of incredulity turned into the laughter of joy. That what we laughed at because we couldn't believe it was possible turned into laughter because the impossible happened right in front of our eyes. And this is often the way of God. Sarah says this in verses 6 through 7. God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh over me. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, yet I've borne him a son in his old age? Like, it's so impossible, it's funny. And she acknowledges that. When you read the story and you say, well, that sounds unlikely. Yeah, Sarah says, it absolutely was unlikely. And we laughed when it happened. We couldn't believe it. That God did what couldn't be done. So the laughter of scoffing became the laughter of joy and surprise. This is reminds me of Psalm 126, which is a psalm in reference to Israel, Judah, being in exile, Judah in exile in Babylon, and the hope that they would come back. And Psalm 126 says, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. And then at the end, it says, those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy. He who goes out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. It's this idea that God take something that we find doubtful and does it anyway. And that there's a lot of joy in those miraculous surprises of God. And he delights in doing it. And we get to delight in him doing it too. Isaac's a reminder of that. So going back to our initial question, what if God's will contradicts all that we think we know? In this instance, everything I know about how children are born and how children are conceived, and everything I know about family and nature and biology and anatomy says this is not possible, that when you get to be 100 years old, it's time to stop thinking about having kids. What if God's will contradicts all that we know? I think this story tells us, first of all, that God's promise is more certain than my knowledge. That I think I know how the world works. And I probably do have a pretty good grasp on it. I'm not suggesting to you that 100-year-olds are going to start having children on a regular basis. But God's promise is more certain than my knowledge. That God's knowledge of what he can do in this world is vastly more better informed than what I think can happen in this world. And so if God says something is going to come to pass, that's more certain than whatever reasons I stack up to say that it won't come to pass. If Jesus says he's going to be raised from the third day, my knowledge says people don't come back from the dead. His promise is more certain than my knowledge. Point number two here, God demands the sacrifice of the Son of Promise. And this is in the most poignant of chapters in Genesis, beginning in verses 1 through 2. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. Remember that phrase, by the way. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. As a father, I can't read that without just stopping me dead in my tracks. I don't know if there is a more challenging passage in Scripture than to hear that story. And as such, it has been fascinating as a tale to moral philosopher for centuries, for millennia, I guess. Immanuel Kant, who's kind of one of the fathers of modern philosophy, references this, and he says, "We can use as an example the myth of the sacrifice that Abraham was going to make by butchering and burning his only son at God's command. The poor child, without knowing it, even brought the wood for the fire. Abraham should have replied to this supposedly divine voice that I ought not kill my good son is quite certain, but you, this apparition, are God. Of that I am not certain and never can be. Not even if this voice rings down to me from visible heaven." So what Kant says is, I am more certain that it's wrong to murder my son than I am that God told me something. That I could never be so confident that God told me something that it would convince me to murder my son. He's deeply interested in this and how the rationale works. Soren Kierkegaard also remarks on it and says, "The ethical expression for what Abraham did is that he meant to murder Isaac. The religious expression is that he meant to sacrifice Isaac. But precisely in this contradiction is the anxiety that can make a person sleepless. And yet without this anxiety, Abraham is not who he is." But he says, you know, it depends. If you're looking at it from an ethics point of view, this is just murder. If you're looking at it from a religious point of view, it's sacrifice and faith. And he says, those are very different views of this story. So I find it helpful to me. I'm not just ranting on Kierkegaard and Kant for fun, but because it's helpful to me when I struggle with the story to know the great minds of human history have also read the story and struggled with it, trying to make sense of what do you do with the idea that something I'm pretty sure I know, it's wrong to kill my son, it's unspeakable and unthinkable to kill my son, would run up against a commandment from God. The stakes of the story couldn't possibly be higher. The text emphasizes that. And that's something I love about the story. The story doesn't downplay it. Sometimes preachers do. The story leans right into the fact that this is difficult. God says, offer your son, your only son, Isaac, the one you love. Like, emphatic. Your son. Well, not this son, that son. No. Your son. Not talking about Ishmael. Your only son. The one we named Isaac, the one we laughed about because of how funny and wonderful it was, the one you love above all else in the universe, that's what's at stake here. The text says this was a test of Abraham. The Hebrew term means something like attempt to learn the true nature of something. And this, while a subtle distinction is important, God is not tempting Abraham in the sense that Satan might be said to tempt us to do evil. James chapter 1 and verse 13 says, "Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man." God doesn't tempt anyone to do evil. God doesn't try to lure you towards evil to ensnare you in sin. God does give us challenging commandments that show who we really are. And that's a fine line, I get that. But there is a difference between being challenged to do something difficult and being lured to do something evil. In this particular case, because we're talking about killing a child, boy, we're as close to that line as we can possibly get. And it definitely gets murky. But the text says this is a trial, a testing, an assessment of Abraham. Also, I would emphasize, and I think this is the biggest point that helps to make sense of this story that gets overlooked. There is a covenantal context to this story. Okay, if you're just out in the middle of the woods and you hear a voice that says, kill your son, you should ignore that voice. I'm going to agree with Immanuel Kant on that one. If the voice from heaven says, hey, kill your son, and you have no context whatsoever to put that in, it's far more likely that you are delirious or deceived than that the God of heaven is telling you to kill your son. That's not what happens in this story, though. Abraham is not, Genesis 22 just doesn't drop out of nowhere. Abraham has an existing relationship with God that precedes this by 10 chapters and quite a number of years. And it's an extraordinary relationship. He gets a call to leave his homeland and a promise of nations in Genesis 12. He gets a covenant and a curse in Genesis 15. And by that, I mean, you remember the story, I hope, of the fire pot and the animals that were cut in two, and the flame of God passes between the parts of the animals. And we talked about that a little bit in a previous week, that what God was saying was that I am making this covenant with you, this promise. And while normally in a covenant, the weaker party is told, if you disobey the covenant, you'll be punished. God says, I myself will take pain and suffering before I allow it to come to you to violate this covenant. God himself accepted the penalty of the violation of the covenant, if it should ever be broken. There's a huge point in this story that God has gone over and above any normal relationship with Abraham and made promises. God has made a promise again in chapter 17 and covenanted with Abraham in the story of circumcision and all that follows in that. There is a renewed covenant. And then after the promise is repeated and repeated and repeated, the promise is fulfilled in Genesis 21 in a miraculous fashion. So here's my point. Before God ever asked Abraham to do something as extraordinary and unthinkable as offering his son, God has already demonstrated that he is worthy of trust. It's not that Abraham's walking through the woods and hears a mysterious voice and doesn't know who it comes from, and it says, go kill someone, and Abraham's, all right, I'll go kill somebody. That's not the story. The story is the God that has made himself known to Abraham, who has established his trustworthiness with Abraham, ask Abraham to do something he can't explain. God's extraordinary command to Abraham was in the context of an extraordinary relationship with Abraham. If you ask me to do something sketchy and I don't know you, complete stranger, says, here, hold this gun, I'm going to find that an odd request. If my wife says, here, hold this gun, I'm still going to find it strange, but I'm going to do it because I trust this person I've come to know over two decades. And I don't understand what's going on. Why are you handing me a handgun? But I assume there must be some legitimate reason because I trust this person. Trust has been established. Personal trust is faith. God has established trustworthiness with Abraham. And so Abraham says, I don't have any idea what this means, but I'm going to do it because of trust in the person of God, not in some doubtable experience. So in verses 3-5, Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. What is it that Abraham's thinking here? We get a little bit of a glimpse. I don't know that we can psychoanalyze Abraham at this point. But when he says, I and the boy will go over and will come back, it's a pretty remarkable statement. He doesn't say, I and the boy will go over and one of us is coming back. Abraham seems to believe that I and the boy, Abraham and Isaac, would both return somehow, even though he knew full well what he was being asked to do. Abraham trusted. Based on prior construction of trust, Abraham trusted that God would keep his promise, even though Abraham had no idea how. Hebrews chapter 11, 17 through 19 points to this specifically. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. What's the point there? Abraham, who had received the promises, right, based on a prior relationship, God had made promises, God had kept promises, is told to do something extraordinary. And he says, the same God who gave me Isaac out of nowhere can save Isaac from whatever happens at the top of this mountain. The God who kept his promises once will keep his promises again. And he has considerable power to do so. Romans 4, 13 through 17 remarks on this as well. For the promise to Abraham and his offspring that he would be heir of the world did not come through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. That is why it depends on faith, in order that the promise may rest on grace and be guaranteed to all his offspring, in the presence of the God in whom he believed, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. Abraham's faith, based on, again, this prior relationship with God, was that God is the kind of God who can bring life even to the dead, that even if Abraham goes through with it, somehow Isaac gets returned to him, who can call into existence things that do not exist. I love that line. Things that currently don't exist, that currently are impossible, God is in the business of doing exactly those things. And that's what Abraham depends on when he climbs that mountain. So in verses 6 through 8, back in Genesis 22, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them together, and Isaac said to his father, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. He said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went, both of them together. I love the little detail there. When God speaks to Abraham, he says, here I am. And then Isaac says, hey, what's going on? He says, here I am. I mean, all Isaac knows is that he loves God and he loves his son, and he's there to do what needs to be done. And I don't know that he knows much more than that. He's going to say it one more time in a few minutes, and it's a touching scene as well. Abraham has confidence that God is going to do something. God will provide a lamb. And he doesn't know how that's going to work out. He just has confidence that something will. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took his knife to slaughter his son. That scene, again, just kind of takes your breath away. I'm always interested when Christian stories are retold through art. And I was thinking about all the famous Renaissance paintings that have tried to capture this scene and how it might have played out, again, called the binding of Isaac, and the emotions that must have been contained in these scenes of a man with knife in hand prepared to do something unthinkable because of the God who kept promises, who had now asked him to do it. It makes what God has asked of us seem extraordinarily small by comparison. It doesn't make the story any less challenging, but it does make you rethink where we balk at God's instructions. So we pause there just for a moment at that poignant moment. Let's go back to today's question. What if God's will contradicts all we think we know? What if God's command seems contrary to what I think is right and wrong? God's command is more certain than my conscience. This one is really tricky, because Jiminy Cricket's instruction to always let your conscience be your guide is usually pretty good advice. However, at the end of the day, we are finite, limited beings, and I don't know the whole story. And God does. God has proven himself to me and to Abraham and to you, that he's the sort of God who's worthy of trust. And so if he asks you to do something that seems in any ordinary circumstance to be wrong, it is worth asking, don't I trust God more than I trust my own ethics? That's what Abraham's being asked to do. Abraham, do you believe that God is good more than you know you yourself know good? Can you trust that he'll do good more than you do yourself? That's a challenging set of questions, and I don't have any easy answer, and I understand Kant and Kierkegaard struggle with it and all the others, and I understand why. But what God is saying here to us is that God's command is more certain than my conscience. My conscience is a good tool, but it has to be oriented around God's will. And God knows more than I do. I have to have some humility about my own perception. I should have my humility about my perception of God's will, too. Right? Again, reinforce this point. Abraham just didn't hear a voice in the woods and say, oh, I guess I should kill my son. But based on an established certain knowledge of God and his command, he believed God knew best and followed him. And it's at this point that God proves to be exactly the person we came to trust in. God provides a substitute for the son of promise. In verses 11 through 12, but the angel of the Lord called to Abraham, called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. There's our third here I am statement. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Here I am. You can just hear the relief. He was ready to obey God, but he is as eager to be rescued as he is to obey. He wants God to intervene, and he's ready when he does. Here I am. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of this place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. So there's a great comparison here then for the New Testament reader, both between God and Abraham and Jesus and Isaac. Between God and Abraham, we notice as God promised, he would accept harm before allowing his covenant with Abraham to fail. Right? God is not going to cheat Abraham. God is not going to be unfaithful to Abraham. And sure enough, God comes through. Abraham had now seen the price of a covenant, but he had not paid it. It's a foreshadowing of how far God would go to keep his covenant with us, which brings us to Jesus and Isaac. Isaac, the son of promise, was spared by the ram. Jesus, the son of promise, becomes the lamb. And God, as he said he would, takes the penalty of the covenant rather than us. So I'll ask for the third time today, what if God's will contradicts all we think we know? The beautiful ending of the story is that God's love is more certain than my fear. Throughout the story, all I can think of are all the ways this could end badly. Instead, it ends with God's grace and God's mercy and God's providence on display in a beautiful way. God's love is more certain than my fear.